That was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time, reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world.
That was the year.
April 14, in an apartment in New York's Hotel Belcaire, sits Russian revolutionist, author of the dynamic play of The Lower Depths, Alexei Maximovich Peshkov, whom the world knows as Maxim Gorky. His broad Slavic brow scowls in white rage as he scans the front page of a metropolitan newspaper.
Maxim, have you looked over your first lecture? Maxim, what is the trouble?
I cannot believe it.
What are you talking about? What is troubling you?
I am sorry, Andreeva, that we came to America.
Sorry? Why? They have given you a beautiful welcome, showered us with invitations.
Oh, that is done. Over. Look here.
Oh, they say I am not your wife.
Yes.
But in Russia.
Ah, Andreeva, this is not Russia. It is America, where newspapers can create wars, make rulers, set a man upon a pedestal or kill him as they wish. This is the land of the free, Andreeva. The nation will... Enter.
Mr. Gorky.
Yes?
I am the assistant manager of the hotel, and, well, I'm sure you must have read the papers, and, well...
And you desire that we leave your hotel. Is that it?
I'm so sorry.
I understand. We will leave at once. Come, Andreeva.
Canceling his scheduled lecture tour, Gorky and the woman newsmen had revealed was not his legal wife retired to a small cabin in the Adirondack Mountains. 7 months later, discouraged, broken in spirit, his health undermined by a racking cough, he sailed for Russia.
19-6. That was the year.
San Francisco, April 18, 19-6. 5 o'clock in the morning, the city sleeps. Then, about 15 minutes later, as though awakening from a long slumber, the earth stretches, clumsily throws startled humans from their beds. The shock lasts but a moment, and 300,000 persons await with tense fear. Then, another more vigorous tremor, and hundreds dash wildly into the streets. Finally, with a nauseating convulsion lasting about almost 2 minutes, the earth plunges the citizens of this western metropolis into a wild, deadly panic, cast showers of bricks, mortar, and concrete into the twisted streets with cataclysmic violence. By 8 o'clock in the morning, those buildings not already destroyed by the earthquake were standing within the very path of a new catastrophe. Fire! The uninjured thousands rushed to the city's parks, clutching their few salvaged possessions in helpless dismay. And then, down the crazy, desolate, uprooted causeway that had been Market Street, marched a regiment of U.S. soldiers from the Presidio, with General Fred Funston at their head, smiling with the innate confidence of uncontested authority. As the bluecoats approached, the citizens of the ruined city saw a new hope, took heart, and began the work of preventing the spread of fire and disease, healing the injured and burying the dead. And when the catastrophe had spent itself in terrible finality, from out the shambles of 497 city blocks, from out the 5 square miles of smoldering ashes, from out the shells of 28,000 buildings lying in pitiable destruction, from out the $1 billion of lost property, there arose a new metropolis. From the union of disheartening disaster and undaunted human courage, there was born anew the city by the Golden Gate, a regenerated greater San Francisco.
That was the year
that one of the most dramatically poignant scenes in history was enacted in Paris, France. 12 years before, in July of 1894, within the stately sanctum of the German military attaché, Colonel von Schwarzkoppen sends this man of medium height, sallow complexion, wearing a heavy, untrimmed mustache. He seems unduly agitated, but as Schwarzkoppen examines him, he sees the wide red ribbon of the French Legion of Honor and smiles.
Now, let me see. Oh, yeah. You want a passport to Alsace-Lorraine?
No, that was a ruse.
What?
Monsieur, I have documents in my possession which your government can use, which they need. I will sell them to you.
Do you mean to tell me that you, an officer in the Army of France, decorated by the Legion of Honor, wish to sell to the Imperial German government?
Yes. Documents. Important documents. I can get others, too. Monsieur, I am ruined financially. My wife is sick. My children do not eat. I must have money. If you do not buy this from me, I will kill myself.
September 26, 1894. In a small room of the Ministry of War...
But, Major Henri, where did you get such an incriminating piece of evidence?
Yes, where did you get it?
I received this paper through the usual channels. A woman in the employ of our intelligence division brings me the contents of the wastebaskets in the German embassy.
Mon Dieu, this is terrible. One of our own officers in this very department, guilty of treason. Who could it be?
Just so. Who could it be?
Certainly not Duval. Not Lieutenant Lebrun. Could it be Captain Boulanger? Or Captain Dreyfus?
Dreyfus. He is a rather quiet, secretive fellow.
And he is...
Yes, Duparty. He is a Jew.
Yes, he is.
Captain Alfred Dreyfus is the traitor.
I am so sorry, Captain Dreyfus, that my hand is injured and I cannot write.
That is quite all right, sir. I do not mind writing for you.
Continue, then. A new line. A note on Madagascar. Ah, the handwriting is the same.
What?
Captain Dreyfus, I arrest you in the name of the law. I accuse you of the crime of high treason.
Ultimately brought to trial, Dreyfus was found guilty of treason. Stripped of his honors, his sword broken, all within the courtyard of the military school, while a mob of citizens and newsmen outside the enclosure hooted, jeered, called...
The dirty Jew!
I am innocent! I am innocent! Long live the army! Long live France! I am innocent!
Then Devil's Island. Years of patient waiting. Years of desolation, loneliness. While back in France, his brother, Matthew Dreyfus, his wife, Lucy, Major Picard, and a few others labored endlessly to find the true traitor. Finally, the accusation was made. It was Count Walson Esterhazy, major in the French army. To disprove the accusation, documents were forged. Letters purported to be from Captain Dreyfus were manufactured, all at the direction of the condemned man's former superior officers. Dreyfus had been tried. He had been found guilty. He was serving his sentence. The matter was closed. Anything to save the army from further embarrassment. Then, the famous liberal novelist Émile Zola picked up the falling torch, issued his astonishing paper, J'accuse, I Accuse, in which he bitterly indicted high officials in the Paris press for their part in the hideous affair, and ended...
I have but one desire, for the truth to be made clear in the name of humanity. My burning protestation is but a cry from the heart. Let them dare arraign me before the court of assesses, and let the case be heard in the open. I am waiting.
Zola's object was to be prosecuted for libel. He succeeded in his purpose, but was found guilty. He appealed, but upon advice of friends, fled to England before his second trial. Gradually, however, and with increasing force, feeling in favor of Dreyfus grew, until, in the grounds of the military school, where 12 horrible years before he had been degraded, surrounded only by a few witnesses, on July 22, 1906, he heard through the mist of memories the voice of General Guillain.
On behalf of the President of the Republic, and by virtue of the powers conferred on me,
I constitute you, Major Dreyfus, Chevalier of the Legion of Honor.
The Dreyfus affair was closed. Those who had accused him, Roger, former Minister of War Mercier, Generals Gans and Boisdeff, were ending their days in disgraced seclusion. Major Henri, who had uncovered the first piece of evidence, had been arrested on charges of forgery and died in a prison cell of suicide. Esterhazy, the real writer of that first note, was ending his days in England, hiding under the cloak of a series of false names. Albert Dreyfus, martyr to hypocrisy, deceit, collusive treason, was vindicated, completely rehabilitated in the army he loved.
That was the year
that in the lyrics of a highly popular ditty, a jaunty little bird was given credit for delivering this potent advice.
Every Saturday, Willie got his pay, then he'd call for Nell. Trousers neatly pressed and nice white vest, buttonhole bouquet as well. On Nellie's little hat, there was a little bird. That little bird knew lots of things it did, upon my word. And in its quiet way, it had a lot to say. As the lovers strolled along,
I'll be your little honey, I will promise that,
said Nellie as she rolled her dreamy eyes.
It's a shame to take the money, said the bird on Nellie's hat.
Last night she said the same to Johnny Wise. Then to Nellie Willie whispered as they fondly kissed, I'll bet that you were never kissed like that.
Well, we don't know Nellie like I do,
said the saucy little bird on Nellie's hat.
In a shady nook by the quiet brook, Nell and Willie fish. Lips together meet in kisses sweet, love is such a dainty dish. Then Nellie said to Will, such pretty things galore, but everything that Nellie said the bird had heard before. And as he took her hand and said, oh, ain't it grand, Nellie winked the other eye.
Now I haven't caught a fish, what do you think of that?
Said Nellie with a most bewitching look.
You can bet she knows her business, said the bird on Nellie's hat.
And Nellie is the fish she's gonna hook. Oh, it's 12 o'clock so early as he took her home. I'll bet you're never out as late as that.
Well, you don't know Nellie like I do, said the saucy little bird on Nellie's hat.
Thank you.